This is Central Time. That is drums. Nothing but drums played by Clyde Stubblefield and Jabbo Starks. They are sitting in the studio with me right now. They
Hello, Madison. I love you.
That's Clyde Stubblefield there. They both played for the James Brown Band. They worked with a ton of other artists between then and now, including their own band, Funk Masters. Clyde Stubblefield, he's lived in Madison for years. He played with the What Do You Know Band here at WPR. There's an event tomorrow night at Madison's Overture Center. It honors him and his career. It's going to raise money for a musical scholarship in his name. Clyde, Jabbo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's thank so you. Nice.
And Joey Banks is here, too. He's a Wisconsin-based drummer. He's with the Coalition for the Recognition of Clyde Stubblefield. Joey, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Clyde, let's start with you. What's on the set list for tomorrow night? What kind of music are we going to hear?
Well, you were starting right with Joe because he's the boss. And I don't know. They call me and tell me I have to be at certain places. I just don't know. But you can ask him and he'll tell you.
All right, we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to hear about you guys first. Jabbo, two drummers in a band, right? You were both in the James Brown Band at the same time.
Yes, we were. Right.
Yeah. Now, usually that's a recipe for one drummer leaving. But you played together. You still play together, you know, decades and decades after the fact. Yeah,
Jabbo. But we never played at the same time.
Right, back and forth. Except that video, I just played a clip of you guys playing at the same time.
Probably so on that.
Yeah. But not with James Brown. You took turns with James Brown.
Well, James took turns.
He took turns with you.
Yeah, but it was nice, though, because I traveled the world and learned things. So, but Jabbo went farther than I did with Brown. And I just didn't like his personality.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've heard he was tough to work with.
Disrespectful, I think. And I got tired of it. Yeah.
But you guys didn't get tired of each other, Jabbo. You guys together. You're still friends today.
Yeah, we're brothers, you know.
Definitely.
Very close friends, yes.
Well, what did you think, Jabbo? First time you showed up, and there was another drummer there, and then another drummer comes along. This is not standard operating procedure.
When I showed up with James, there was five guys on stage.
Five.
Yeah, now that is kind of comical. So I didn't know. I asked him, I said, you know, why you want me here with five drummers? He said, well, just stay here and just watch the show, and you'll see. And gradually it moved down to three, and then it was Clyde and I. And he said that, well, it's going to wind up being the two of us. That's the way it's going to have to wind up. So we were the two drummers that stayed there together.
Correct.
And, Joey, I want to get into this show tomorrow. Give us the details. What can we expect?
It's a Mad City session show at the Overture. It's going to be in the lobby. It's a free show, which is, I think, incredibly outstanding that you see these two great icon drummers for free, along with Wally Ingram, who is another local drummer. Who's played with Sheryl Crow and a bunch of people. It is also going to be the proclamation to naming it Clyde Stubblefield Day. That'll happen at 6:30 p.m. You don't want to miss that. But this is the third show in a series of shows that supports the Clyde Stubblefield Scholarship Fund, which started by the Coalition of for the Recognition of Clyde Stubblefield, and this is the big finale of the show for that event.
We've got a link to information on the Central Time Facebook page. Clyde, the scholarship fund in your name, what does that mean to you, helping hand down music to another generation?
It's an honor because I like to work with kids and give kids the chance to do something. It makes a big difference in my life, you know. And Joe has been taking care of business so well. It's unbelievable the things he has done. And I respect him highly. But working with the kids and getting this here honor, it's an honor to me. I worked with Pete, another schoolie, that they gave me an honor of being with the kids or something. I don't know what it all was. I don't know. I don't follow my background.
He's playing at the halftime of the East High School game at Bree Stevens tomorrow. Okay. which is a big deal for him.
Played with no high school band, but
all right. You're not going to march though.
Oh, no way. That's kick, out.
And Jabbo, you're up here visiting. You've got regular gigs, I think, five nights a week last I read. Where are you playing? I'm in your hometown.
I'm in Grayton Beach, which is I guess you say it about 25 minutes out of Destin. I'm there 5 days a week. This is my 18th year there.
Mm-hmm.
Same restaurant. Yeah.
And you're up here, and you're playing tomorrow night. And a couple other bandmates, I think, are here, right?
Yeah, I think Fred Wesley and Fred Thomas will be here tomorrow.
Now, what does it mean for you two guys, you know, these people you've known for decades and decades, right, getting together and just getting up on stage and playing
again? But, you
again.
Know, it's an honor. It's a love that we have for each other.
Correct.
That's why we, you know, we do this, you know, because like I say, we're all doing something different now. But when this came about, you know, you couldn't miss this for him, you know.
They take care of me royally. And, you know, we take care of each other. Yeah. So it's like. Like a lot of fun to participate in these things.
Now, you said doing something different. I want to go back to when you were drumming and you were the original funky drummers. What did you set out to? Did you say, "Hey, I'm going to play the drums differently than what I'm hearing right now. I'm going to invent something new"? Jabba, you're shaking your head.
No. You must understand. I play me. Clyde plays Clyde.
Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless to what else comes about, you know, they may want to try and change you, but you don't change. You can't, you play what you, who you are.
Correct.
And that's what we did. You know, James won't just sit down and try and show you, say, well, I want it played this way. You said, okay. And then you turn around and play it the way you're going to play it anyway. So,
and James Brown didn't notice you played it your way. And
he once he thought he had gotten his point over, and that you were going along with it, it didn't really dawn on him what was going on.
Well, did he eventually move on and, you know, start yelling at the bass player to play something else and forget about the drummer then?
No. He didn't do that. Once he got into a groove, he didn't have time to do anything but try to do whatever he was doing up in
front.
I got to ask, you now, if somebody's going to learn drums, you are a couple of the people they're going to listen to. When you were starting, who did listen to? Who were you listening to back in those days?
I'm saying for me, I listen to everybody. I do that right now. You never stop learning. I don't know enough. I'm still learning. But I tell you this, I tell each young drummer, do not try and emulate what you see me doing. You won't play. You can't play like me. You have to play like you.
That's
you take
right.
some of what I have and add to what you have, and then you'll have yourself. But you can't do that one.
And Joey, let's bring you in on this.
And that's really Clyde's influence on me. When I was a young 16-year-old kid playing in Madison, that was the advice that he gave me, and it really inspired me to keep going and being myself, being my own drummer, and do my own thing.
We're going to pause in just a moment, but Joey, you are a drummer. These guys aren't going to brag on themselves enough. Brag on them a little bit. What do they mean for drumming?
I can't even begin to tell you. You know, from a genre standpoint, from funk to hip hop, I think these guys are the founding fathers. If there was a Mount Rushmore, they would be on the mountainside, their faces, in my opinion.
Maybe we need that. It's a drum extravaganza in here today. Clyde Stubblefield and Jabbo Starks are with us, drummers for James Brown and so many more. Joey Banks is here, Wisconsin drummer. And tomorrow night in Madison, there's an event in honor of Clyde's career and to raise funds for a music scholarship in his name at Madison's Overture Center. Veronica Rickert here. We continue our conversation now with the original funky drummer Clyde Stubblefield, his James Brown bandmate, fellow drummer, and longtime partner in beats, Jabbo Starks, and drummer Joey Banks with the Coalition for the Recognition of Clyde Stubblefield. They are all part of an event tomorrow at Madison's Overture Center honoring Clyde's career, raising funds for a music scholarship program in his honor. So I got you guys here. I got to ask you questions I've had about how the music came together when you guys were playing in that band with James Brown. Go ahead.
Well, Jabbo here is the one that kept me playing drums. I love Bobby Blue Bland, and I didn't know who the drummer was till I got with Brown and found out he was playing too. And I said, "You play with Bobby Bland?" And when I know that, because Bobby was my idol, and the music, his drumming, man, you had me going for years.
But then, you know, even with that, with James Brown, you had, when we were there, you had the guitar players. You see, a lot of times people will say, the drummers, the rhythm section made James Brown, put it that way.
I'd say that.
There was Jimmy Nolan and Alphonse Kellum.
Uh-huh.
They were the first two that really the guitar playing, two guitar players that sit in. It really had it down. You
know, be right over my shoulder, then, Jimmy Nolan.
Then after they left the old band, then came Bootsy and Catfish. You know.
Ugh.
So, but then see with Clyde, when Clyde and I was there, well, you know, it got a little different. But we were at rehearsal, not rehearsal, sometime in the auditoriums, you start just playing little riffs, and the drummer, we would start going along with it. And you didn't know it, but James Brown was somewhere listening, and he heard it. Then he'd come back and tell you to play the same thing that he'd already heard. Then he'd go say something in it, and that was it.
That's what I wondered, because it's so intricate how the drums, the bass, and the guitar, the rhythm guitar, goes together. And I was wondering, did somebody orchestrate that, or did you just start playing and
you
worked into each other?
You're locked in with each other. Nobody orchestrate. You just locked in. You started a groove. They started, and you sit in there, and you just started playing that groove. That's what you got into.
Yeah, it's like when we're in a studio, we start setting up, and once we get set up, we start grooving on stuff. And Browner walk in, has no idea, and go, hey, what's that y'all playing? Just keep it going. I put some lyrics to it, and it become a hit.
Yeah, you know? I heard you would just, it wasn't like, okay, we're going to play a four-minute song. You just keep playing and playing and playing. He'd sing a little more, and you'd take 4 or 5 minutes out of that. I don't know, how long did you play for a track?
Well, what you did was, see, that's when I used to hate to record with James. And no lie, he would come in late as usual, but then he wanted to sit. He wanted to work himself up in a friend. He would get sweaty, and you play over and over and over and over and over and over, and you just keep playing till he felt like he'd figured out some lyrics to say, and then that was it. But I just hated it, man. Then they would cut whatever part they wanted out, they would cut that out and use it, you know. But he was, I mean, it was a hassle to record with James.
Well, I'm a sax player, and it seemed like he always would fade it when Maceo started playing a solo at the end of a song. What was up with that? Did he take it off sometime?
Maceo had got on to I guess you call it a hitch with Maceo, but like the arrangements that was done from Pee Wee Ellis and Fred Wesley. But see, Maceo had his style, because Maceo came into the band as a baritone player. And from there, he went to tenor. And from tenor to alto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to get technical. I got some drummers in the room. And what strikes me about the funk beats that you guys played, a lot of the rock at the time and still is doon-cha, doon-cha, right? The backbeat with the snare. And you guys are like, you hold the snare till later. You hit it like doon-cha. Dude, if I can sing the drum parts right. Is that the key, like where that snare could show up anywhere?
To tell you the truth, I've never had a lesson.
I've never had that.
It's what came out of here. And see, if this is what I heard in here to go up to here, that's what I play.
That's right.
That's just like him. You won't find anybody that's going to play like Clyde. You're just not going to do it. Clyde plays Clyde, and I play Jabbo, and that's
Jabbo,
it.
We never try to play like each other.
And I think if they would have went with that program of two and four, funk would have never been created.
Right.
I mean, they had to be original. They had to not think in those terms to be able to create the genre that they created, which also ended up creating another genre, hip-hop. And really, there's a subgenre of funk called breakbeats, and there's a bunch of bands that basically they've developed from their beats as breakbeat bands. Breakestra, Grey Boy All-Stars, a lot of these newer funk bands of today are still doing what they were doing 40 years ago.
What's it like to hear, whether you're being sampled, maybe even ripped off, or paid tribute to, however you want to say it, but what's it like to know that you're such a huge part of music today, you guys?
As such a disrespect for what we've done.
Right.
I don't care, you know, okay, we're not getting the money that we should have got. We should get, but at least you could say, "Well, we took this from Clyde and Jabbo, and this is what they were doing. We were trying to emulate what they were doing." You don't even get that, but yet still, they're making the big bucks. You know.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting some respect at this event tomorrow night. And one question I asked, Joey, do you know what's on the set list?
I do know what's on the set list. We're going to do some Pass the Peas. We're going to do some Doing It to Death. We're going to do some Ain't It Funky Now. We're going to do The Funky Drummer. And I think one other tune I think Clyde is on. But that's the gist of it. We're going to do about five tunes. And I think the final two tunes of the set are going to be songs that Clyde made famous.
Fantastic. Jabbo, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Clyde, thanks to you as well for coming back to us at WPR.
It was an honor, brother. Thank you.
Joey, have a great event tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Three drummers, Joey Banks of Madison, Jabbo Starks, legendary drummer for the James Brown Band, and the man of the hour, Clyde Stubblefield, the original funky drummer, performing tomorrow at Madison's Overture Center. We've got event details on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our next guest says he wonders if being black can be bad for your health. As a black man and a doctor, he's had close-up experience looking at health outcomes when it comes to race.
From disparities faced in medical school and the doctor's office to the unique cultural, social, and economic factors behind health problems in the African-American community, his new book takes an in-depth look at the experiences of black Americans in the healthcare system.
We're joined now by Dr. Damon Tweedy, a psychiatrist at Duke University Medical Center and author of the book Black Man in a White Coat, a Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. Dr. Tweedy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, in the introduction of your book, you do write, being black can be bad for your health. This is something that you encountered across your career. Can you tell me more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think it really kind of started for me as a first-year medical student when you're learning about all the different types of diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, you name the disease, basically. And professors would sort of have these two comments. They would say that the disease is more common in black people. So first they would just talk about sort of the biology and the science of it. Then they would go into the sort of the social aspects of it. And then they would say, this disease is more common in black people. And then they would follow up by saying, black people who get this disease do worse. And so it was sort of like this, it was a refrain. And what they didn't go into from there was why that was the case or what you could do about it. And so a lot of this book is really about exploring that those questions and using stories from patients that I saw along the way to really illustrate the many reasons that would work, why being black is bad for your health.
Well, this was a journey for you to go on. You started off at your time as a medical student at Duke University and some of the ambivalent feelings you had there. But what were those first years like for you?
Yeah, so, you know, medical school, so I come from a very working-class background. Parents did not go to college, and medical school was sort of it's a new thing for anyone in my family, for sure, and in my community. And so, you know, everyone who goes to medical school has certain anxieties and uncertainties about whether they're going to, how they're going to do. It was magnified for me, given the background I came from, you know, being an African-American man, which is, you know, a very sort of an outlier in the medical field. But I was attracted to medicine by this idea that it was objective, you know, that it was sort of, you know, it was science, and it was hard, you know, there wasn't any of this sort of messiness that you see in other areas of life in terms of race. But when I got to medical school, you know, I sort of had this rude awakening, if you will. And so it was a struggle in the very beginning.
And you had an experience early on that you write about. You were really excited into getting into some of the clinical material in your course. And the professor there saw you come into the room.
Yeah,
and he walked over to you, and what happened?
Yeah, so that's like the opening chapter in the book after the introduction. So, you know, so the book really has two themes. So the first theme is just the stories about the African-American patients and the health problems they have and using real people to illustrate those. The second part of the book is really about, well, the second aspect of it is the story of what it's like to be an African-American man in medicine and the ways in which you're perceived differently. And so the challenges, the struggles you face. So in this particular case, I'm coming into the classroom about a month into the first year, starting to feel a little bit better about things. And I come back into the classroom. A professor comes up to me in a somewhat angry, irritated way, and you know, says, "Are you here to fix the lights in the room?" And I told him no. I was sort of taken aback. I was looking at myself to see if, you know, I'd done something wrong or dressed wrong or whatever. And then he said, "Well, you know, if you're not here for that, then why are you here in my class?" So it was really this sort of kind of a really aggressive sort of way of saying, you know, maybe I don't belong. And that was sort of how I took it. And so the book kind of goes into how I dealt with that and all the sort of back and forth that you deal with. And so it's like medical school is hard enough on its own. And then here you are sort of dealing with this other sort of mental gymnastics to sort of deal with race and how to manage it and what do you do in this situation. So the book really illustrates some of the extra challenges, you know, that I faced along the way.
Right, and yet it is a course of understanding over your entire career. What kinds of self-reflection did you end up doing about how black patients get treated today in the medical system and how that might be different than, say, a more privileged patient, in that case maybe someone from a higher socioeconomic class, maybe a white patient, might get treated.
Yeah, it's complicated because, you know, you're talking about issues of class and race, and often, you know, that sometimes you can separate it out, but often they're sort of intertwined in ways that we still are grappling with, you know, as a country, and so it's tough. And so often the African-American patients are you know, the lower socioeconomic class. And there's no doubt in medicine that there's different levels of care. I mean, you know, something that people don't really talk about openly, but there's no question about that. I illustrate that in the book. I use an example where I go to a clinic about 90 minutes from campus. It's a charity clinic. So here you're talking about a free clinic. Patients were all black. No one had health insurance. And the kind of care you can deliver is very different. You know, the patient, the things that you could do at Duke as far as tests and medications that you take for granted, actually, you just can't do. And so there's no doubt the patients are getting a different level of care. And all too often these things are still, black people are still bearing the brunt of that. So that's sort of like a big system, society-wide things. And then there are other things as well that I talk about in the book as well, as far as other issues that cause different levels of care with black people.
We're talking with Dr. Damon Tweedy right now. He's the author of Black Man in a White Coat. And high blood pressure is an issue that you struggled with yourself. It was one of the early markers to you that you needed to change the way you cared for your own system, your own body. But it's also a health disease that affects a lot of African Americans. So what did you learn about that along the way, about what might need to change and how it gets treated?
Yeah, so it's one of those prototype diseases for health disparities, actually, because it's clearly more common in African Americans, and it does follow a much worse course. So African Americans who get high blood pressure are more likely to develop things like kidney disease, heart disease, stroke, all the sort of things that kind of come from it. I mean, there's no question about that. So here's the question: is like, why is that the case? And I think, you know, there's all sorts of theories about it. So some people say there's somewhat of a biological component, and you know, there certainly could be. But what I would say to that is that, you know, genetics is not destiny. Even if that's the case, the far bigger issue in this particular case is sort of the social, cultural, socioeconomic aspect to it. And so for me personally, I was actually diagnosed with high blood pressure myself in my early 20s. And, you know, at this point, I'm young, healthy, I'm a medical student. Why is this happening to me kind of thing is what was going through in my head. For me, you know, diet was a big part of it and sort of the cultural side of it. And, you know, eating certain foods that you've kind of grown up eating and then trying to change those is very difficult. Change is hard for everyone, but when you sort of add cultural and racial layers to change, it makes it even that much more difficult. And so when you see a patient in a clinic, you know, the standard routine for high blood pressure is you give them medication, they come back. If it's still high, you give them another one or change it or increase the dose. You know, you do those sorts of things. But, you know, maybe the next question to ask the patient is about their diet and sort of leave room for the patient to ask the question, like, you know, maybe what's getting in the way of us making the progress that we need? Because in talking about an issue like that is a deeply personal one. So you need a good doctor-patient relationship to really be able to sort of uncover some of the real problems that may be getting in the way. So for me, diet has changed my blood. Diet has worked so much that I don't need medication, and my blood pressure is completely normal. And so, again, this whole idea that biology is destiny, you know, I don't believe that in the vast majority of cases. It's really the social and cultural factors are much more important.
Do you think that those conversations between doctors and their patients, really going in depth, mm-hmm. taking the time to get to know one another, is that part of the secret, do you think, to overcoming some of the racial disparities in medicine?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of barriers to that. You know, being a doctor is just hard, and there's a lot of pressure to see people in short periods of time. And I totally relate to those struggles, and I totally understand that. I think one of the things that sort of hurts black people often is that, that we're more likely to receive care in settings where you wouldn't know the doctor. You go to an urgent care clinic, you go to an emergency room, where things are really rushed. The doctor doesn't know you. They're more likely to make quick judgments, and that's where sort of stereotypes and bias can even come out more so. If you actually know the person, you get a relationship with the person, those things are much less likely to occur over time. And so I think it's really important, and so that's the case where African Americans are less likely to have that kind of care, and it really does work to our detriment.
Now, over the course of your career, have you noticed things about both how patients get treated differently, but also maybe how African American doctors get treated differently?
Yeah, certainly. So there's a couple cases I write about in the book where there's patients who, you know, yeah, there's one particular case where there's a guy comes in and he has chest pain, you know, middle-aged black guy has chest pain. You know, the routine thing there is to make sure he didn't have a heart attack. So then you want to give him medications and you want him to stop smoking, those sorts of things. And so the doctors discuss all what to do afterwards. But they wanted to talk about nutrition. And actually, they wanted to just give him medicine. He wanted to try and eat better and lose weight before they gave him blood pressure medicine. They really bristled at that. And I think it was really interesting because we were in a public setting, and I think the doctors really had low expectations for the patients. And so this guy was really smart, and I think it just really took them aback. And afterwards, they were were sort of debating after we left the room, you know, what kind of mental health problem he had. Like, was he obsessive compulsive? Like, how could he know this much? And it's really, and so that's, I think that's not something that would have happened in a different setting where there was a more affluent group of people you were seeing. So that's where bias can come in, for sure. Now, as a black doctor, I've experienced several cases where I talk about in the book, where particularly when I was a young doctor, where people would openly question my competence. A couple people even used, there's one case where a gentleman used racial slurs to indicate he didn't want a black doctor. I even have African-American patients who were concerned about me having me as a black doctor. So there are all sorts of negative things that sort of spread in people's minds about what the capability of an African-American man in particular. So I've certainly struggled with that.
So as we wrap up, Dr. Tweedy, what do you want your colleagues to know who aren't African-Americans about what they could do to bridge that gap a little bit and change the care that they give patients?
So a couple things in the book. So for the bigger public, I think one of my goals is really educating people about these issues. So many people are just not aware of the health problems in the African-American community and the ways in which they can be helpful, even if they're not in the medical field. So I think that's one big part of it. But as far as my colleagues, I think I just want people to, you know, there's this whole idea about I really just want people to sort of be able to, you need to understand the community where people come from, and you need to understand people's backgrounds, but you need to not use that as a way to sort of stereotype someone. So you need to understand the context, but then still be able to see someone as an individual. And I think that's what any really good doctor is able to do. And that's what I've been trying. I teach medical students. I teach doctors that are in training, and I'm really trying to impart those lessons to them. It's not about stereotyping, but it's really about understanding people and then trying to reach them as individuals.
Dr. Tweedy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Damon Tweedy talking about the relationship between a person's race and their experience in healthcare. His new book is called Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflection on Race and Medicine.